Take your Bibles tonight and let's go to the book of 1 Samuel and the 30th chapter. I want to spend a little time tonight talking about what made David such a great leader of men. Took considerable time, over 2 weeks, to talk about one of his failures. Maybe we should balance that out by talking about the kind of man he was really deep down inside. It's interesting, as we're going to find out, the thing that impressed God about David, impressed is not probably the best word, but it's that thing that God cared to mention, was David's heart. Says his heart was whole with the Lord. So often we tend to look at people in terms of their successes, in terms of what did they do. David was a great military leader, and David was a great this and a great that. That which God mentions, that, by the way, which God says in comparison between David and his son Solomon, was that your father's heart was 100% with me. His heart was right. That's what impressed God with David. That's the thing that God cared to tell us about. And I think even more significantly, we're going to find that that's what makes David different as a military leader. I have no doubt that, as in most of the people who fought in those days, I've told you before, the Bible does not picture him as a little boy. The Bible pictures him as he was an armor bearer for Saul, for a year before he went to fight Goliath, and he's the one who took a lion by the mane and clubbed it to death, and he clubbed a bear to death. Those aren't things that little boys commonly do. You know, they club things, but usually not those. But that's not what's impressive about him. What's impressive about David is the way he handles himself and the way he handles people. In 1 Samuel chapter 30, I just want to talk about an event that occurs and to show you what the Scripture centers on and why the Scripture chooses to emphasize certain things within this text. What's happened is that David is running away from Saul through this period in his life. And Saul's at war with the Philistines. David allies himself with the Philistines, in fact becomes the, if you will, the servant of the Philistines, a mercenary of the Philistines, which is really odd because when David becomes king, his mercenary bodyguard are Philistines. They're called Pelethites and Cherethites. Those are just other names for Philistine-type people. And so David becomes a mercenary for the Philistine. And in chapter 28, he almost gets trapped into fighting against Israel because the Philistines say, come with us. And then at the last minute, they say, what are we doing? You know, isn't this David? You know, we don't know if he's with us or against us. So they sent David off. While David was gone, the Amalekites, a Bedouin-type people, had raided his city that the Philistines had given him, where he and his men were living, called Ziklag, had raided that. It says in chapter 30, verse 1, it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag, they had been up to the great meeting of the Philistine armies on their way to fight with Saul. On the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south, the Negev, and the Ziklag, and attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire, and taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. What's happened is that the Bible is presenting us with David's loss, with David's defeat, with David's problems, and showing us how he deals with those. So often we tend to look at people and their greatness as going from victory to victory. He beats this opponent, he beats that opponent. I think not only the Bible, but even human experience shows greatness is demonstrated. What do people do when they lose? How do people handle defeat? How do people handle those things that in which they're not successful? And we're being presented with this whole incident about David that's set not in the sense of a Goliath scene where, you know, he opposes Goliath and goes to victory, but we're set in the face of his loss and what's he going to do here. So what I want to do is to show you how the passage develops. It's really quite simple. First, it shows you three major problems that David has that are brought to light by this defeat. They're personal problems, long-standing problems that David has and that he needs to resolve. And what a defeat does is it really brings out the character in you and really demonstrates it. And so the defeat shows the flaw, and then you can see him applying his character to overcome each one of those three flaws, each one of those three weaknesses. First, there's a defeat. Then that causes the problems to surface. You see these problems that have been there for some time, and then the passage shows us how David overcame those and how David moved on from there. Let's take a look at the flaws that this defeat showed out. It says in verse 3, "So David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire. Their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive." First point we've already sort of made, but I want to emphasize it. This is a problem that's come about because of David's doing things his way. David's playing politics. David's walking the fence and choosing to go a certain route and playing footsie with the Philistines. Come back with me to chapter 27. David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel, so I shall escape out of his hands." You ask yourself, what kind of situation would a believer find himself in that his answer is, "God can't protect me anymore, so I've got to go to the Philistines to protect me"? So he comes down there. By the way, remember what happened the last time that he had gone to the Philistines. He'd gone to the Philistines once before and they tried to kill him. They said, "Isn't this the David?" By the way, he showed up the first time carrying the sword of Goliath. You know, one he'd used to cut off Goliath's head. And he shows up in Gath, that's Goliath's hometown, you know, where, and he shows up there. And they want to kill him. And so what does he do? He played like the madman. He let the spit run down his beard. You know, like a rock star. He wasn't doing all the weird stuff. And they all, and Achish said, "I don't need another nut. You know, I got enough of you. You know, get rid of this guy." So David escapes, even though he looks like a fool. This time, though, he has some stature. He's known to be an outlaw to Saul. And one of the political stratagems of that day was you entertain the disenfranchised and the disenchanted people of your enemy's court. You take in all the rebels from your enemy's court, and then someday you can use them against your enemy. You can divide and conquer your enemy. The Egyptians had made a tremendous strides in foreign policy by doing that. They would always take in the rebels from Israel and then ship them back there one day when the time was right so they could divide and conquer. This time, that's what the Philistines do. So it says in verse 6, Achish gave him Ziklag that day. David never would have had his family, his wife, his children, and his men in an exposed position where they could be attacked the way they were if he hadn't put himself in that position by going and offering himself as a mercenary to the king of Gath, to one of the Philistines. He had put them there. And then he played this weird game. It said, so David and his men raided the Geshurites. By the way, that's going to become his son-in-law. Absalom is going to be the son of a princess of Geshur. The Gerzites and the Amalekites, for those nations were the inhabitants of the land from old, as you go to Shur on the way down to Egypt, just south of the Negev. Whenever David attacked the land, he wouldn't leave anybody open. He would kill everybody, and he would come back. He'd attack the enemies of Israel in the Negev. Then he'd come back and tell the king of Gath, "Oh, I was out raiding in Judah. You know, oh, I was out raiding the Israelites." So Achish thinks to himself, In verse 12, Achish believed David, saying, "He has made his people Israel utterly abhor him. Therefore, he's my servant forever." So David thinks he's really clever. You know, he's playing both ends against the middle. He is helping the Israelite, the Judah people, I should say. He's helping them by destroying their enemies and building up goodwill in Judah. And he's making the king of Gath think that he's doing a job for him and that the Israelites hate him. So he thinks he's real clever. He thinks he's got the world on a string. But God brings him up short with Ziklag. When he gets so deeply involved, now all of a sudden in the next chapter, 28, they're going to come to him in 29. They're going to come to him and say, "We want you to go with us when we attack your people." He's going to make some choices that could have really put him in danger if the Lord hadn't worked. But the way the Lord worked was by a defeat. The Lord worked by the terrible things that happened to his city and to his people at Ziklag. So the number one thing that he has to do is, this is a problem of his own creating, his own fooling around, his own messing around in politics. What's he going to do about that? 2, then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the wife of Nabal, the fool, the Carmelite, had been taken captive. You see, David has to know what to do with his emotions now. Here he has suffered a tremendous loss. These are Semitic people. You know, they're not Westerners and Americans where we hide our feelings. They revel in them. They're very, very emotional and a deeply emotional people. I wouldn't have cried. I would have been mad. That's the reaction of a Westerner. Downright mad. But these are people who every emotion is right out there. Everything is out there. What's David going to do about that? It said they cried until they had no more power. That doesn't mean they just cried. They didn't have any power to do anything. They were absolutely powerless because of their greed. These are 600 killers. All right, I mean, call them mercenaries, you know, call them soldiers. What they do for a living is take iron and put it in somebody else's body. Okay, that's what they do for a living. They raid other peoples. You know what you do when you raid other people? That means you do the same thing to other people that they do to you. Okay, you raid them, you kill the children sometimes, you sometimes kill the women, you're stealing. These are hardened people. These aren't people. I've never killed anybody. You know, the only people I've ever seen die have been in hospital beds. These are hardened people, but their emotions are right there. How are you going to deal with that? It's like they don't have no more power to weep anymore. And David's in trouble because now his people see his weakness. They know, understand very well, you know, we stirred this up. We've been out raiding the Amalekites, it said, right? Why'd the Amalekites come and raid them? Well, they'd been out doing it to them. And as soon as David was gone, they found out and moved in. He'd stirred up this trouble. Now they see him in his weakness. They see him that, you know, he's overcome by this. And notice his third problem here. Now David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. Now that might add to your burdens. Because the soul of all the people was bitter, every man for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself. There's a problem here. David has gathered around him a mixed multitude. If you go back to chapter 22, one of the passages we often preach on is that all the people who were disenfranchised and distressed and poor and all the people that had been put off by Saul, they all gathered to David and David comforted them. And that's a really great thing, but how would you like to start a church with that group of people? We'll just take all the churches around, everybody who's been hurt, everybody who hasn't had a successful experience, and everybody who's down, and everybody who is angry about something, and everybody who's been done out of something, we'll take them in and start a church. Wow, that would be a fun group to pastor. You know, and what David did is David, his heart is open and he's tender, but he had started with a mixed multitude. These people now want to stone him. They want to kill him. Now, that's not all of them. You know, people are stirring up the pot here, but David doesn't have a group of people who are stalwart, righteous, with the Lord kinds of men. He's got a mixed multitude with him, just like Moses had. And he has to deal with that. This is a weakness that David has created himself. You see, because the righteous and the stalwart and the stable people, they're with Saul. They're serving in the regular army of the Israelites. They're not with David. So David has created these problems for himself, a problem of his own doing things himself and trying to play both ends of the middle in politics. He's got a problem because the very character of himself and his men that made them so effective was also very deeply emotional, all deeply off the edge. How is he going to deal with this? And then the problem that by the very nature of the robbers and outlaws and that had gathered to him, he had a real mixed multitude here. These were problems that were there long before the Amalekites raided the city. But it's the crisis. It's that moment of terrible distress that brings to the surface all the problems that have been there for a long time. Question is, what's David going to do about them? You know, there is no servant of the Lord that doesn't have those weak veins running through them, like fault lines in rock. You just don't find solid rock. We talk about it, but you know, solid rock isn't very wide. You drive along the highway, you'll see layers of rock, you know, and there's fault lines in between. There's lines where things are. And the strongest individual has these weaknesses in his circumstances, maybe not in his character, but certainly weaknesses in the circumstances. Decisions you've made that have seemed right at the time, years later, rise to give you problems. God doesn't choose servants who go from one success to another success unbothered by failure. What God does is he brings these things into our life to expose the weaknesses and to say, what are you going to do about them? I want to know what you're going to do about this. And our defeats and the things that we suffer, they're not there to personal. They're not losses. They're not things where we say, I'm not successful anymore. It's God's hand, it's God's light exposing and saying, what are you going to do about this? I'm showing you. How many of you have taken your stove out from the wall recently? Anybody? We have. You know, there is nothing more discouraging than looking at a stove after it's been sitting in one position. You know, all the things that have boiled over in the last number of years, all of the little things that have just managed to fall down. Amazing the things you find behind a stove or a refrigerator. You know, they all accumulate there. And it's not until you do major renovation work. It's just not every... Maybe some of you, I'm glad I'm not married to a woman who does this. As it's spring cleaning, take the stove out, we're going to clean it. Now, that's too much for me. But, you know, it's not until you go through major renovation work that all of these things come to light. And you say, wow, look at that. Or I didn't see that. I would remember what it was they found when they took the stove out, something about the way it was wired or something. But there are things I never knew we had that situation. These aren't disasters. These are the Lord saying, I am going to renovate your life, and you've got to do these kinds of massive upheavals in order to change things. Well, that's what God was doing in David's life. This wasn't a failure. This was God's using it to say, here these weaknesses are, what are you going to do about them? So notice how David deals with these in order. His first problem is he's been messing around doing it the human way. Politics and going this way. He's been putting his strength and trust in the Philistines and in his own right arm. Notice what he does in the end of verse 6. He was grieved. Everyone was grieved for their sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. The Hebrew says he found strength there. The person who changes their life, the person who, when the problems are exposed and the weaknesses brought out, is the man who says, I'm going to find strength in God. It's the woman who knows how to center herself and to say, I live and move in God. It's the teenager who says, God's involved in this. It's not a family crisis. It's what can I do with God? Can I find strength in God? There is a real crisis in America today. We're depending on techniques and methods and all kinds of things to get us right. But how many Christians know how to find strength in God? How to go to God, and when they walk away, they're stronger. Go to God, who's the source of all strength. God, who is any moment willing to give you every last thing you need. and to go there and actually get it. You know, it's like we've raised a generation of Christians, given them a handful of quarters, put them in a room full of machines, you know, a candy machine, a coffee machine, a sandwich machine, or whatever, and they don't know how to eat. They got the quarters, all right there, you know, the preacher gave me these quarters, I know that. And they got the machines, it's all there, and then they're starving to death. They don't know how to put the quarter in the machine, to push the button, to go chink chink, and to watch the food. They can't do it. They don't know how to get strength from the Lord. David did. He realized, I've been messing around with people. I got to get it with the Lord. I can't put my trust in the things of this world. I can't put my trust in my wits and in my abilities. I got to get it from God. He started in the right place. This is the turnaround. I think it's interesting that in most Bibles, this is the last phrase of verse 6. This is the point where the whole passage turns. He found strength in the Lord his God. It was his own God. It wasn't the God of Israel. It was the God that had moved in his life. It is the God that he had worked and chosen himself after God had chosen him in ages past. But this was his own God. And it says, then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod, or the ephod, to David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this troop? David not only finds strength in God, he says, God, what do you want me to do next? He knew how to make his moves, not with political moves. You know, I can do this, and I can play this guy off against this one. He says, it's time I find out what God wanted me to do. I can't believe how much of our problems we're trying to figure out, what's this move, and what should I do here? Hey, what does God want you to do? Go to God. Start working for God and not for people, not for yourself. And he goes. Now, this what's key here is you would say, what kind of question is this? Somebody steals your wife, your kids, your food, and your car. You're standing there. Now, Ziklag's burned to the ground. You can't live in Ziklag. You can't go back to the Philistines and say, you want to give me another city, please? I lost the last one. Give me a new one. You can't do that. You see the tracks. I want to tell you, 400 camels we're going to see later on definitely leave signs of their passing. You could follow them forever. You think, simple, go get them. David doesn't do that. His new walk isn't to make decisions that seem logical, to make the military decision. His new way is to say, I'm getting back and finding out what the Lord wants. If the victory's of the Lord, I go to the Lord and ask. It seems so simple. Just do it. You ask. You find out what the Lord wants. He's changing his ways. He's saying, I'm not going to do that anymore. So not only does he find strength in the Lord, he changes the way he acts. And he says, I don't do that. I'm not that kind of person anymore. That's what makes David so great. He's the kind of person who changes. He's the kind of person who says, Lord, you've exposed that weakness to me. Now I do things different. The answer was, pursue. You'll overtake them. By the way, we have no idea how he got that answer. We know that inside the ephod, which is like a fancy vest, if you will, you put it on. It's got a breastplate on it. And inside it's got something called the Urim and the Thummim. But this isn't a yes-no answer, is it? You know, pursue, for you'll surely overtake. How do you know? David knew. The Lord revealed in a way to David he's never done to me. You know, I've never had that kind of an answer in my life. But that's how God worked with David. God says, you know, I will give you that answer. David not only found strength in God, he found God's will. Very simply, right where it had always been. You got the priest, you got Abiathar, you got the ephod. Do it that way. Notice, so David, he and the 600 men who are with him, it says the brook, Besor. Brook is what I think of Six Mile Creek back here. You know, gentle brook. Not right now, of course, but most times of the year, that gentle brook. What a brook is a place where when it rains, the water rages through 10, 15 foot deep. But the rest of the year, which is the other 10 months of the year, it's dry. So it's a huge canyon or wadi. The 600 men get there. They've been traveling here and there. They're out in the middle of the desert now, south of the Negev. They're working through the southern end of the Negev. And it says, where those stayed who were left behind. Interesting, we'll come to what that means next. David pursued, he and the 400 men, for 200 stayed behind. They were so weary they couldn't cross the brook Besor. We're going to come back to them in a moment. So now his force is cut by two-thirds, and he's still pursuing on. He's left behind the people who were just too weak and too tired to pursue. Then they found an Egyptian in the field. They brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate, and they let him drink water. It's interesting that we go from David's dealing with himself, his own ways of doing things, and turning to God, and now we turn to how David's going to deal with this Egyptian. Why tell the story in real detail here? It's going to tell you, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. It's telling you what they gave him to eat. It's not just saying, you know, and they gave him. It's giving you details. This must be important because they're details. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him. There's the key. Everybody's getting their strength back. David got his strength from the Lord. This guy's getting physical strength back. God's going to use him. For he had eaten no bread and drunk no water for 3 days and three nights. To whom do you belong? I am a young man from Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite. My master left me behind 3 days ago when I fell sick. Here we see the difference in David's character. Here we see that, and by the way, one more. We made an invasion of the southern area of the Cherethites, that's another name for the Philistines, in the territory which belongs to Judah, and the southern area of Caleb, we burned Ziklag with fire. David's problem, remember his second problem? Here is this intensely emotional person. Here is this man, a leader of an intentionally emotional band. Here is one of the guys that burned your city, that took your wives. Here is a guy just like, remember, you left 200 behind who were too weak to go on? There's a guy that they left behind who was too weak to go on. What are you going to do with him? He's utterly and completely in your power. He's one of the creeps who had done this to you. What are you going to do? You set out to kill every last one of them. Here's the first. You know, here's a little chunk you can bite off right away. What David did, by the way, before he even knew who he was, he fed him. And it's interesting, they're feeding him on a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. Those aren't the kinds of things that men normally carry when they're about to make a quick force march into the desert. This isn't the bread, this isn't the water, this isn't the light provisions that you carry. They obviously rooted around until they found something that had high sugar content, something that would restore that person quickly. You know, when you've been playing ball or when you're running outside in the hot weather, you don't come inside and say, bread, give me bread, water. No, you want Pepsi. Nothing like Pepsi on a hot day. You want chocolate. You want something sweet that revives the eyes. So that's what they gave to this guy. Not knowing they could use him. They didn't do it to use him. They did it just because of the kindness that was within him. And then when they find out he's one of the enemies, by the way, he's a servant of the Amalekites who had done this to them. He's going to be contrasted with 2 Samuel chapter 1. Remember the Amalekite who killed Saul, who David has killed? This is a way of tying the book of 1 and 2 Samuel together. The Bible will do this. We'll tie together two stories. Two Amalekites left behind in the force. An Amalekite who was serving with the Philistines, and servant of the Amalekites, an Egyptian who was serving with them. Two stories that kind of linchpin together. And David says he doesn't kill him. He doesn't do that. He says, can you take me down to this troop? And the young man says, if you don't kill me, I will. You know, it's kind of you think it has to work in that order. You know, if you kill me, I can't tell you much. But he says, if you don't kill me. So David did. They brought him down. They see the Amalekites and they kill them all. Kill them all. 400 get away riding on their camels like Ahab, the Arab, through the desert sands. They take off. Every other one was killed. There must have been thousands of them, or the fact that a mere 400 escaped wouldn't have been significant at all. Question is, what's David going to do now? Why the rest of the chapter? Look what it's about. So nothing of theirs was lacking when they rescued everything, neither small nor great, nor sons nor spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Plus, then David took all the flocks and the herds that were driven before the other livestock. These are Bedouin. Bedouin livestock is the spoil. Bedouin carry only goods that are things you can carry. They don't have homes. They don't have land. They don't have dressers and furniture. All they care about is livestock and gold. Usually in a Bedouin society, you'll see the women wearing all the cash of their clan. When you see a woman who has all of that, in fact, you ever seen the wedding garb, you'll just see gold hanging down. That's the dowry she's bringing. The women are holding on to the cash in that society too. They've got all the money. You know, the men, they may think they're doing what they want, but the women are holding on to the old cash. And so they have that, but their real wealth is in their herds. So David takes all, he's a herdsman too, he takes all the herds, and notice what he says. David said, "This is David's spoil." Why does he do that? I mean, are we now supposed to find that David is saying, "I'm the great victor and I'm the one who did all this"? This is really fascinating. You're being told this because David obviously saw, and we're going to see as it works out, there's going to be a problem with this spoil. David foresaw this. He knew the character of the men he was dealing with. He foresaw there was going to be a problem, and he said, "I'll take control of this. This spoil, I will say what is done with it." Let's see why he did that. Now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary they couldn't follow David. Notice what the author of this passage is telling you. He doesn't say the 200 losers who died and couldn't make it. He doesn't say the 200 quitters. He says the 200 men who were just too tired, they couldn't follow. Whom they also had made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. When David came near these people, our Bible says he greeted them. The Hebrew says, he said, "Mashlom ka." How are you doing? Are you okay? Are you just fine? You know, we left you here. He was concerned for these people. He greets them. He doesn't wait to be the conquering hero. He comes out and he says, how are you doing? We left you. We've been thinking about you. Then all the wicked and the worthless men, the men of Belial, who went with David. Don't ask me how it is, but the stinkers stay. You know, he left the nice ones behind and only the stinkers stayed. You know, David won out once again. Those were the tough and the hardy ones, you know, the things that, you know, gave him the bitter tongue and also gave him the strong legs, I guess. And David answered and said, and all the wicked men, it says here, because they did not go with us, we won't give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, and except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. They're a bunch of losers. They left us. They can have their wife and kids, and they can go. Not only is that greedy, not only is that completely unacceptable in the eyes of God, it's cruel. These men have nothing. Their homes have been burned. They've left everything. Now they can take their wife and children in the middle of the desert and go someplace and make a living. You're virtually condemning them to death. Notice what David said. Fascinating, the wisdom that he shows here. How is he going to deal with this mixed multitude? Remember that problem that had surfaced when they wanted to stone him? Third and final, how is he going to deal with that? The wisdom that he shows. He says, "My brethren." He didn't say, "You creeps, you low life, you." He didn't say any of the things that might come more naturally to others of us. He didn't vent on them at all. He says, "My brethren." Fascinating, you see the same thing with Paul writing to the Corinthians. He keeps calling them, even when he rebukes them, he keeps saying, "We're brethren." So he talks to the men, he says, "You know, we're all together here. I'm the boss, and you do what I say." He says, "We're all together here. We're brethren." But notice what else. "You shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and has delivered into our hands the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? Who's going to pay any attention to what you say? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so his part shall be who stays by the supplies." He says, "I got news for you. It took all of us to get here. Even though we all didn't make it to the end, it took all of us, and that's the law." See, David could do that because he said, "This spoil is mine. I'll tell you what happens with it." But it wasn't his. He didn't do it to make it his personally. He says it's of the Lord. And it made it a law. Notice what it says here. "And so it was from that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance." David's wisdom in dealing with these things on the spot became not only proverbial, they became law. That would be the rule. The rule wasn't to the victor goes to spoils. They belong to the people. It's share and share alike. By the way, I won't go through it, but at the end of the chapter, you know what David does with the rest of the spoil? He sends gifts to all of the people in Judah who had helped him. All fairly, you can, if you go through this list and find them all, they're not just from his area. They're from all over the southern area. David takes this spoil and invests it in his future. These are the people who helped him before. These are the people who may help him again. You see, David's now using wisdom and generosity. David's now dealing with the people in such a way to bring them together, to take these people scattered throughout Judah and to promote goodwill. How do you deal with a mixed multitude? How do you deal with that? Well, that's how David dealt with it. He used some foresight and made sure that what was necessary for him to control, he controlled. He used kindness and graciousness in the way he talked to them. He demonstrated fairness and wisdom. And then he used some real foresight in saying, hey, listen, we're going to bring our people together. And he didn't just give the spoils to the people who went to battle or to the 200. He shared them with everybody. That's what made David such a great person. It's why this passage takes so long for one little incident to show you that defeat was there to point out the flaws in David's life, the flaws in his circumstance, in where he had brought himself to be, a very dangerous place. And God brought him low so that he would show what he really had, and that was his walk with God. That was the genuine kindness and concern for people that was inside his character. What he showed for the Egyptian, what he showed for those other men, and that was his wisdom, his ability to deal with people and to solve all of those three problems. Incredible how the Bible brings this out, and we read it one morning for devotions. Let's pray. Father, I'd ask that you bless us tonight. I'd ask that we'd really understand how you work, that the things you do to point out to us what needs to be changed. I pray, Father, that in my life to begin with and others, as you show us the need, that we would be doing this work, that we would be great individuals for you. What we are and have, we have in Jesus' name. Amen.